Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome to the Friday discussion edition of the show. You guys know the deal. If you would like to support the show, get access to our bonus Ask Me Anythings that are exclusive for Supercast subscribers, you can go to realignment.supercast.com. Once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. It's basically, when I'm talking about Supercast, a better version Patreon that really helps us monetize, take the show to the next level. I'm actually, Sagar, we're recording this on Thursday. I'm about to head to my first ever in-person recording in Austin with a great guy, Josh Steinman. We're going to talk about industrial policy and defense, all those great things. So that is thank you to Supercast subscribers. Once again, huge thank you, everyone. Let's kick off with a really interesting post that is obviously going to reference us, but was also just a good post. Mark Andreessen broke from his social media silence and posted a blog called What I've Been Up To Lately. For Sagar and my sake, he cited us as basically the top podcast he's been on recently, and he's talked with Tyler Cowen and Joe Rogan. So like that's a Sam Harris, Richard Ananias, that's a really huge compliment. But within the broader piece that I want to send people to, there's a set of book recommendations he gives. And we've actually read a bunch of those books. So we'll of course link this book recommendation list in the episode show notes, but I thought it would be cool for us to talk through some of them because it's just a really great set. And I know folks here like books. So let's just start with the section on the American right. He breaks these up into sections like that. Lindbergh by Scott Berg. I haven't read Lindbergh, but I'm pretty sure it's on your Audible, right?
I have it behind me. It's one of my favorite books, a great book. I highly recommend people read Lindbergh. He classifies it as a history of the American right. I actually read it as a history of American technology beyond, because I was interested in two things about Lindbergh. Number one, Lindbergh, the Lindbergh pilot, as in the story of the first flight, what it all was, the history of early American aviation, because I read, who's the guy who just died? Oh, God.
Oh,
totally blanking.
Oh, wow.
The Wright brothers. David McCullough.
Yes.
There it is.
Yep.
David McCullough. I read David McCullough's book on the Wright brothers, and one of the things I couldn't get over is that even though aviation was invented here in America, it actually was more of a European discipline for the first like two decades of flight. The French surpassed us. Anyway, so I was like intrigued by Lindbergh. There's a reason that the flight, by the way, was New York to Paris and not New York to London. Anyway, so I was really interested in what exactly who Lindbergh was. And you also learn a lot about the early American period of isolationism, why he was very popular. You know, people don't know this, but the reason that Lindbergh was such an isolationist, so afraid of the Nazis, is he arguably was one of the only Americans who understood the power of the Luftwaffe, because Goering and Hitler were obsessed with Lindbergh. As an icon, because he was literally one of the first global celebrities to ever exist.
Could you say what he did? I think we dropped that. Why was he so famous?
He was the first person to fly from New York to Paris. There was a prize. I'm blanking on how exactly much money it was. Lindbergh was one of these guys. He used to fly postal routes. This used to be a big thing. So you know how we have airmail today, which is more expensive? Well, at that time, it was even more expensive. But they would deliver the like historically expensive, quote-unquote, airmail. That's kind of how he got into aviation. Really interesting guy. He had kind of a troubled childhood, and he was very young. He was only like 25 years old, and he was one of those people who was like, I'm going to go for this. He heard about the prize, and he started designing the plane, helped, found some people, and really put his life on the line. I mean, he basically couldn't even see. He had to put his head out the window, filled the whole thing with fuel. I don't even think he had any food, and flew all across the Atlantic, New York to Paris. I think he landed in Paris at night, and it was a sensation. It's difficult to even describe. It was in the 1920s happened.
And 27, right? The spirit of St. Louis.
It presaged a new age of globalization. The idea that New York to London or New York to Paris in 8 hours, not 8 hours, but obviously I forget how long the flight took. I think it was like 24 hours, something like that. But anyway, it was still crazy. It was not a steamship. So it was a huge thing. He was, like I said, massive global celebrity. And because of that, he was especially a hero on the European continent. Lindbergh got very familiar with the Luftwaffe. He met Hermann Göring. He actually was one of the first people. The U.S. military was like, so what's going on in those Nazi factories? And he was one of those people. And yeah, I found his whole rise and story interesting. On top of, oh my God, I forgot the baby.
Yeah,
that was Lindbergh the other one. That was the first crime of the century. Like literally the very first crime of the century. There's really only been three crimes that ever captivated the American public like that. Lindbergh, Charles Manson, and O.J. Simpson. So,
and
yeah, there's a lot to say about
his baby was kidnapped and murdered, right? Was that the story?
Yeah. It was a horrific story. And there's still a lot of questions as to exactly what happened. I mean, basically this guy like climbed a baby, ransomed, and eventually came out the baby was dead. It irreparably damaged his psyche and kind of made him go a little bit crazy, which they get into in the book. Anyway, the guy who wrote it also wrote a biography of Woodrow Wilson. And I think he's a very good writer. So I highly recommend that people go out and check it out. It's a very big book, but it's worth it.
Yeah, it's hefty. I think it's at that 31-hour Audible category, which means it's the heavy investment, but also definitely a good use of an Audible credit. It's interesting because this is in the section that Mark calls six books on the deep history of the American right. The one that I actually just finished was The Ambassador, Joseph P. Kennedy at the Court at St. James's by Susan Ronald. It's a really interesting book because you and I are obviously very read in on Joseph P. Kennedy. There's obviously The Patriarch. There is Joseph P. Kennedy Presents. The Patriarch is the big bio of Joseph P. Kennedy. Joseph P. Kennedy Presents is really interesting because it's basically Joseph P. Kennedy during his Hollywood years. That's literally the book's subtitle. But The Ambassador is about his disastrous time as U.S. ambassador to Great Britain at probably the peak time that that mattered in the 20th century.
Yeah.
In the sense that you're being the U.S. ambassador right before the start of World War II and during the debates over appeasement and the obvious like contention between Churchill and Chamberlain. Really interesting, because what's so fascinating about it is that, like, and I think this is also why I think the Kennedy stories are really captivating for people like you and I, is that unlike the typical, oh, it's because they're celebrities, each of the Kennedys, when they're engaged in politics, it's deeply personal. So when Joseph P. Kennedy is making terrible errors, it's not just the fact that he's pursuing and supports the appeasement policy, which plenty of people did. It's that literally he, on an interpersonal level, is making huge miscalculations. He's talking shit about the British. He's
and
going
the president,
and giving
President Roosevelt.
The president. Yeah. He's giving interviews to the press where he thinks they're off the record, but it's actually on the record. And the reporter quotes him as saying, "Democracy in Europe is finished, and the only way America can succeed is by basically becoming a fascist dictatorship." It's wild. And there's a story that I know you would enjoy. Towards the end of Joseph P. Kennedy's resignation, before he resigns formally, he goes to Hyde Park, which is where, FDR's home base. He's supposed to be there for a weekend. And what happens is he goes and meets with FDR. The meeting happens. Eleanor comes in. She says, "Hey, like, what's up?" And FDR is like, "I want him out of here now." And she's like, What are you talking about? You know, like, it's supposed to be for a whole weekend. It's really awkward if he goes. Like, once again, guys, this is the time of like the train. So going to Hyde Park in New York is not an easy investment. And he's just like, "I don't care. The next train is at 2. Entertain him. I don't want to see that man ever again," basically. And what the author suspects happened is Joseph P. Kennedy pulls all the crap he pulled, and he most likely demanded that FDR appoint him Treasury Secretary after all that. And FDR was just so exhausted by 3 years and then just that final just deep arrogance that he just wanted nothing to do with him. So this is a really interesting like personal story. A couple other ones that I want to go through. There's a section on the Spanish Civil War. I'm pretty sure you and I have not read anything about the Spanish Civil War specifically. Like, obviously, no, books that cover it, but like, Mark thinks that dedicated study of the Spanish Civil War is, quote, useful because it was a trial run for the next 100 years of Western history. I'd kind of like push back on that a tiny bit, but I guess fascist versus communist, I should probably read about the topic more. But a great one here is Hitler, A Global Biography by Brendan Sims. It's on my Audible. What's fascinating about this one is there's a lot of Hitler bios there, obviously. We all know the story to a certain degree, but his is deeply focused on like Hitler's ideas, like Hitler's ideas of world politics and how it works. So like his ideas of Lebensraum, his idea of like how Germany worked racially, how it intersected with the United States. My fiance Olivia is listening to the book, and she pointed out that folks have probably heard this story about how the Germans took a lot of inspiration from the American model when it came to segregation and racial policy. And Brendan Sims, and this is like crazy that he points this out, says that it's actually much more nuanced in the sense that Hitler, the quote is, Hitler wouldn't understand the concept of an octoroon. And as I understand it, an octoroon, isn't that when someone's like 1/8 black?
So to be fair, octoroon is more of a like West Indian term than an American term, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
I'm parsing it almost too much, but it is funny to learn the history of this stuff. Yeah, oh yeah, what you're talking about is Saint-Domingue. That's how they used to talk in the pre French Revolution Haiti. These were the most racially obsessed people on planet Earth. They, like you said, they would refer to people as octoroons, quadroons. In America, it was mostly just mulatto, which is funny. Anyway, I think it's an amazing historical fact.
Yeah, and his point there is that if you actually read Hitler, not just Mein Kampf, but like the sequel to Mein Kampf that didn't end up getting released, Hitler is a weird pessimist on Germany's racial issues, in the sense that the reason why he wouldn't recognize the concept of an octoroon is he's just like, oh yeah, well, Germans are polluted by blood anyways, so we might as well do the best we can, but we're probably maybe even screwed. Like one of his concerns is that there had already been enough intermixing of the German race that he thought his position, like with the Nuremberg laws, were already an accommodation. He thought he was a pragmatist on racial issues. So it's just like very, very, very interesting to look at those ideas. There's a lot of other books that I want to get to other topics, but like once again, the last one I'll just reference, Lenin by Victor Sebastian.
I love that
Sagar,
book.
You and great I book. I have my book copy, but I also listened to it on your Audible. Really great book, a really interesting figure, almost in a way kind of, it's not that it's more useful to study Lenin than study Hitler, but another book we enjoy is a book by Arthur Herman, and it's about how Lenin specifically was a revolutionary during a time that the world order was blowing apart during World War One. So studying these, and it's kind of funny, like but please jump in because I don't want to like monologue too much here. But the thing that's interesting about Lenin and how like much of an intellectual he was is that it feels like intellectuals matter the most during moments like these, when people don't have language, when established systems are breaking apart, like when the Tsar, because once again, like Lenin didn't come in right when the Tsar fell. The Russians tried a weird internecine democracy for a bit before the Soviets were able to like take advantage and basically beat the center leftists. So the point here is like it's moments like these when people like Lenin are the most most relevant, I think.
No, absolutely. Yeah, there's no question. I mean, I think the story of Lenin is really interesting because it's one of the most improbable but impactful stories of all time. He had no business becoming who he was, but then he ultimately did. And he really was actually an ideologue. And I think that's one of the things that he's most underestimated for, is he genuinely believed in a lot of what he ended up doing. He stuck by it even whenever it was unpopular. And the ultimate like expression of the Soviet state really was rooted in his ideas that he came up with all throughout the 1890s and the early 1900s, when he was bouncing around from exile in European capital to European capital. So I recommend that everybody go and read it, because even if you're like, don't like socialism, to me, it's more about the state of Russia and like what Russia is, what it was, what it's become. There are flavors. If you are interested in modern Russia today, I think that you have to be familiar with two things: the regime of Joseph Stalin, which of course came after Vladimir Lenin. And I think you have to study the Russian czars. You need to understand the concept of autocracy and autocratic rule. And I don't just mean that when I'm saying like autocratic countries. Like there were people in the 1890s who worshipped the idea of autocracy, like as a governmental system. And, you know, this post-industrial, which is why it sounds so crazy. But yeah, no, people really need to learn that. And I think I understand Putin, I think, a lot better for being familiar with those times.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because we'll get to Elon Musk on a couple of different levels in a few sections. But the interesting thing here is, and you get this from the books on Lenin. So an obvious beef that Putin has with Lenin is basically carving up the Russian Empire. And mm-hmm. part of the reason why, I believe this is Arthur Herman, so I'll be sure to put the book link in the show notes. His argument for our historical understanding of why Lenin did that is Lenin is just an actual communist. Yeah. And he thinks that ultimately states don't matter because we're going to transition from this form of capitalism to this weird stateless communistic world order. So from his perspective, when he's making Finland independent from the Russian Empire. Finland was already basically like quasi-independent,
the Baltics,
but he actually just
Baltics.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's just, but he officially like cuts off Finland yeah. from the Russian Empire. The Baltics become independent. You have like differing conversations on nationalities. You obviously signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which was the first treaty that the Russians signed with the Germans before the Germans lost the war. They're okay giving up the empire because his whole point is, oh, it doesn't really matter. And it's a way for us to repudiate the legacy of the czars. Now, obviously, if you're Vladimir Putin, you're like, hey, Putin's not a communist. So giving up your empire because of this foofy post-state order is the height of stupidity. But it also just represents like why he has this deeper conception of what Russia is and what Russia should be. So let's get into the two topics that I covered on the show this week, and I'd love to get your thoughts on. So one would be semiconductors. I spoke with Chris Miller about his new book, Chip War, basically the history of the microchip and the broader implications with US, China, Taiwan, global competition. I'd love to start with your broad thoughts on chips. Like what should happen? How do you define the status quo? Do you like the various acts that Congress has passed? Like what's your ideal state for how this should work?
Yeah, I mean, I think the CHIPS Act is fine. I don't think it's all that revolutionary. I think it will help. I guess I'm more pessimistic because, and I'm sure you guys got into this, but actually, why don't you explain it? Which is that, Marshall, tell people how long it takes to build a fab, like one fab, before a single chip can roll off the line.
it takes years. It's
5 to 10 years. Yeah.
It's incredibly expensive. And this is really one of the most, because the key thing here that really has to be illustrated here is it's so hard to do. This is actual talent in people's brains.
Yeah.
That basically you can't just say, okay, like, why don't we just like build this at home? Because the answer is actually very straightforward. Yeah. It doesn't work like that. And there's a reason why we do things the way we do them. And the thing that's so hard here is I asked Chris, is this like a story of like globalization gone wrong? And to his point, it's like, well, like not really, in the sense that it's perils and promise, right? Because the promise here is that our entire world is built off of the fact that the Taiwanese are incredibly good at building microchips. And that's just like the underlying fact. This isn't just like with, let's say, like the auto industry or other manufacturing, where it's like in exchange for saving $2 off of, let's say, this mug, we eviscerated the Midwest. That's not the situation with chips at all. Like it actually turns out that the Taiwanese in the late 70s and 80s were actually able to build the best semiconductor / microchip industry you could imagine. So it really, and this is where the difficulty of the Taiwan question comes in. Like
my only quibble with that, if I would, with Chris, is that my one thing is that you're right that the Taiwanese are really, really good at building them, but at the end of the day, they are designed here. So like to me, the IP and the design, now look, I understand why it evolved that way. And also there's certain Taiwanese like work, people should actually go read. One of my favorite interviews is, there's an interview that the TSMC CEO gave, and they were like, why do you always beat America? He just said, you people are lazy. We work 24 hours a day. He was like, he's like very basic about it. He's like, we work 24 hours a day. We work 7 days a week. He's like, your bullshit workers laws are something that would never fly over here in Taiwan. And that's why we beat you. He's like, it's actually super simple. So I think there's an element of like cultural, just like brute force that Japan and Taiwan have always been able to trump us in terms of just the way that our economies function. But put that aside. I mean, my main thing is, look, I agree it's very, very, very difficult, but I also think that we don't really have a choice. But the problem is that we're actually just so far gone that the vulnerability is just going to exist for the next 5 to 10 years. And we just have to accept that fact. And that's a really hard fact because most people, like you said, they think it's like cars. By the way, actually, cars are not that easy to build, especially electric cars.
Yeah.
But chips are way harder than cars to build. And yeah, the more I've learned about it, the more pessimistic I am that we can, quote unquote, just build it all back here. Just because it's like EVs. It's like you can have a factory here, but if you don't have all the inputs, which we don't, you know, there's all this stuff going on right now with like lithium and all the other raw materials. It's just it's a titanic task that we have ahead of us. And that's why when I say chips, I'm like, yeah, it's fine. I'm like, is it going to solve it? No, you probably need $1 trillion to solve it. And there's just no political will to do anything like that.
Yeah. And it's basically the thing he pointed out that's really concerning is, once again, everyone, if you didn't listen to the episode, be sure to do so. But 90% of all of our technology is dependent on chips. And like this is like a fascinating example of how dependent everyone is on chips. Like obviously there's a big debate we could have about the and have had about the Russia sanctions policy, but one of the most effective part of it, if it's uncontestably true, is the chips side of it. The Russians do not have a chip industry, and they're literally so dependent on chips, as are we all, that they are taking microchips from dishwashers and microwaves to power their missiles and other battlefield technology. And the reality here is we also don't really make chips in high quantities. So it's easy to imagine a world where there's a Taiwan invasion and or a blockade, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And essentially what you have happen is we're all having to like, it's kind of funny. You think of FDR. I mean, this is me just totally talking out of my ass, but FDR seizes gold during the Great Depression. Is there a world where like the US government has us turn on all of our microwaves so we can desperately get access to microchips? Because they're in everything. You think that's, yeah. I mean,
and
I think,
our iPhones, we'd all have to give up our iPhones. It'd be over. We'd literally like turn them in.
It's a whole thing. And the real disturbing thing is, as Chris basically pointed out, the factory and the specific TSMC factories in Taiwan and the underlying technology is so fragile that if there's an invasion, whether or not we win, whether or not we lose, it's basically just screwed. And that will be a disaster for everyone. And a really concerning point that he pointed out is that there have been indications that the Chinese are under the impression that it would be possible for them to seize the factories. So like there's a conversation to be had about, A, obviously, like the TSMC engineers need to be the first people out if anything happens. And B, something like I kind of like said off the top of my head, but he said this is actually a serious proposal, like mutually assured destruction. This wouldn't be mutually because it's one way, but just sort of like, hey, you should know if you invade, we're blowing up.
Yeah.
Like we're just going to blow up the factory because the factory is so, so sensitive that basically like if a single grain of dust gets into the procedure, so that's not lasting missile strikes.
I'm glad you did that episode. I really want people to understand that because I've done the same thing. The more I dive into it, I'm like, man, I'm like, it's a miracle it exists, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's
like it really is a miracle.
Yeah. I'm like, I don't know how you guys did it. I'm sure a lot of people probably died / worked themselves to death doing it. But, you know, the entire global economy is built on the behalf. Look, we need to get serious. I know that we won't. It's like the refinery thing. It's just, you know, it drives me crazy. I have very limited ability. I at the end of the day, I am really making peace with the fact that I cannot do anything about this and I can just sit back and observe and, you know, hopefully be right. But just to watch it all happen, I'm like, God, you know, we should have been doing this 25 years ago. And I'm like, at the very least, we should be doing it now. You know, the one good thing is we have some TSMC stuff that's opening in Arizona. I think Intel's building a plant in Austin. So we have some, but it's like you said, 100%. If that factory goes down, say goodbye to the fucking smartphone. It's over. We're turning them in. The government will seize. They'll probably take my computer. They'll take all of our MacBooks. It's done. I mean, I think we probably have enough to operate for like a year at the national defense level. But beyond that, I mean, at least we designed it here, but it would still just take 10 years before we could even roll one off the chip or roll one off the line.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
I'm really interested when you say that you don't think there's anything you can do. Like, I'm obviously like not tooting your horn here, but like millions of people like watch what you say. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious. So do you kind of get what I'm saying? Like, it's just interesting to me that you think that you, you're not saying that doesn't matter, but you still think there's nothing that you're doing that has any impact. I'm interested in that.
No, I think I help people. Yeah, you're right. Actually, that's the most, one of the most important things you have whenever you're in my position. Or look, I'm not even that big. Compared to people much, much bigger, is to realize like
in your niche, like we're not Mr. Yeah. We're not Mr. Beast here.
Right. Okay. So let's say political commentators, I would probably say I'm in the top 20 in the United States. Okay. Fine. I mean, it just doesn't matter. The truth is that the only people that matter are the people who power listen to. So I could have 10 times the audience that I have if nobody in the Biden administration knows my name, which I guarantee you 99% of them don't. Then who cares? I have no impact. So like I've just made my peace with that, especially with the Ukraine stuff, with TSMC. I just think that we have a very tight, you know, Eric Weinstein. Look, I think he has a very good term for this, the GIN, the gated institutional narrative. And I think he's fundamentally correct, which is there is a gated institutional narrative. There are players within that narrative. What they think is the only thing that matters. What the rest of us think doesn't actually matter at all. And every once in a while, you can penetrate the gin. If every once in a while, the stock ban was one. I'm trying to think about other examples. They're very, very limited examples of where you can find, you know, lab leak after a year. But on policy, no, I don't think it really matters at all.
So I want to switch to something less pessimistic than the coming super semiconductor / microchip crisis. I'm sure you saw Mr. Beast say that he could see himself running for president in 20 years. For listeners who aren't teenagers, don't have younger kids, or are allergic to YouTube, like Mr. Beast is basically like the biggest YouTuber in the world. And he was getting interviewed on a show and he said like, yeah, I could see myself like running for president in the future because my audience is so big. And I actually want to take that seriously and engage with it because on the one hand, I think because you and I are decently read in history, we are aware of the tension between, oh yeah, you know, that's a fair point. Like Ronald Reagan is, you know, Mr. Beast is getting more views than Ronald Reagan got. If he gets political and gets interested in that, he could translate that into something. It's definitely possible. But on the other hand, I then hear Mr. Beast say, what would be so cool about it is like, I could just, you know, intersect with the system and not care what like lobbyists do and think. And I hear that and I'm like, if you think that's the level this is operating under, it's funny. You should get into my Audible because this is relating to this instinct. And this isn't me just trying to dunk on Mr. Beast. This is what happens when outsiders who don't pay attention to DC run into DC. So the divider, which is Peter Baker and Susan Glasser's history of the Trump administration. It's more of indecent. I definitely recommend people listen to it. I've had enough time to like disassociate from those years, but it's useful. But they tell this very funny story where Senator McCain, RIP, is sitting out of Jared Kushner towards the start of the administration. Senator McCain says, hey, like we need to change the Pentagon's defense procurement process. Say whatever you want about John McCain. Like that is the definition of a conversation that you should have at the start of administration. Jared Kushner interrupts him and goes, Senator, the Trump administration is reimagining the entire government. We're not going with the small fish. And then John McCain apparently just like literally didn't say a single word the rest of the meeting and dined out in that story until he passed away. Because it's the definition of all you have to do is do some basic Wikipedia searching or like half-ass listen to one of our podcasts from 6 months ago and be like, hey, it's not literally just corruption and stupidity that makes one unable to reimagine America. And obviously Mr. Beast isn't being as arrogant as Jay Kush is when he says like, I'm just like not going to have lobbyists and I'm just going to like do the things that need to be done for the people, which is the direct quote. It's like, that literally isn't how this works. And that's the issue,
which is that no, and this is why it annoys the crap out of me. Once again, no offense to Mr. Beast. He's only 24 years old, so maybe he will learn in time. But Mr. Beast, like, the reason that you're super popular is because you don't actually believe anything. You just do videos which make people smile. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. But that effectively makes you like a morning show TV host from the 1990s. Like, did Katie Couric going to run for president? No, that's like a patently... Actually, no, no. Honestly, she's more serious than Mr. Beast. Like,
Johnny
Carson.
She was
an actual journalist. Johnny Carson is a good... Johnny Carson was one of the most known men in America. Like, was Johnny Carson a political figure? No. And in fact, by the way, his bosses would always tell him not to be too political whenever he would be on the air. So it's like, well, the reason that Reagan is not a good example as to why he or one-to-one is Reagan actually was political and was the governor of California. Even Trump. Everybody looks at Trump and they're like, oh, you know, if he can do it, anybody can do it. I mean, Trump was flirting with politics since the 1980s. 40 years, not only of becoming famous, but of putting forth an actual ideology, which happened to hit at exactly the right time, and also embedded himself and ran in a Republican primary where he's willing to basically burn. I don't know if anybody knows what a Q score is. It's actually a very interesting concept.
Yeah, I love this.
It's a Q score is like how basically how audience, how yeah. warm audiences feel towards you on television. And so like an example would be The Rock. The Rock probably has a very, very high Q score. I'm trying to think of somebody. Oprah has a very, very
Matthew
high
McConaughey.
Q score. Matthew
There's
McConaughey.
A theme here.
Like universally loved people. Yeah. But again, like outside, I mean, Oprah is slightly political, but anyway. So Trump used to have a very high Q score and he was literally willing to burn his entire Q score and to become overnight, by the way, this happened whenever he went all in on birtherism to become political in 2011.
Polarizing.
Still didn't run.
Which is the opposite of what you should do if you're a star.
Bingo. Right. So yeah, right. Exactly. If you're a star, by the way, I don't know if people know this, but you know, Macy's ties, you know, the Trump ties, they pulled his line after birtherism and after the 2005. It cost him a lot of money in terms of his retail deals. Ivanka also had all the stuff with Nordstrom. The point I'm making is that being a star is not the same thing as being political. And to be successful in the political realm, being a star can help. It can be a jump off point. But you have to give up a lot of what you're actually good at, a lot of the reason that you have any appeal whatsoever. And yeah, I would not presume to think that because some six-year-olds watch my videos about giving away PlayStation 2s, that they're going to listen to what I think about Ukraine, you know, or that even frankly, that I would, you know, to have the audacity to think that because of that, you can then translate it into something more serious. I mean, I'm not going to quote who told this to me, but look, let's be honest, you know, Mr. Beast can be the most viewed YouTuber on earth, but does he have any impact on popular culture whatsoever? Zero. I mean, effectively zero.
Mr. Beast Burger is transcendent, but other than that, but so what I mean by that is when people see him literally fill a New Jersey mall.
He is undeniable. There's no question, but it's still all a question of like, look, I can't tell you what it is. I don't know. I can't tell you what it is, but I don't think he has any real impact on pop culture. And I know why. And it's because all of his popularity is derived from not being controversial and from not really taking a position. And you just can't build anything off of that except make a shitload of money, which, hey, look, more power to you. Yeah.
Yeah. And what I think what you're getting at is everything you're describing is why I think Matthew McConaughey didn't run for governor of Texas.
Yeah, correct.
100% it. He obviously polarized himself with the White House gun stand, but I think he just personally, because Uvalde is literally his hometown, I think that like was above the line for him. But clearly, I was, you know, once again, talking to, you know, Olivia, my fiance's like family, they're like, we love Matthew McConaughey. They're all like very Trumpy and conservative. Like, love that guy, you know? It's very hard to set that on fire. This is also why, despite your and my discussion of how The Rock could conceivably be a serious presidential candidate, he's not going to do it. I don't see a world where I'm going to probably steal this from you, man, because it's very helpful. Most celebrities, especially when there are a few, if any, figures that are going to reach the level of love people have for them, lighting that Q score on fire is just going to be like Trump. This is your point. Like Trump was driven by something bigger than just the need.
That's Q. Yeah.
To his Q score. It's a huge thing for him. But I just suspect like a lot of we're going to see. And the reason why we're harping on the Mr. Beast thing is once again, like I know a lot of people were sending that clip around and taking it very seriously. Logan Paul, I think, has also said the same thing. Like this is this sounds silly, but this is like a real idea. And I'm just really letting people in on what the 2030s are going to look like, which is you're going to see a bunch of people talk it up, take it to the last section, then realize like, wait a second, it's actually probably not going to work out. And I probably really shouldn't like light my career on fire.
I don't think any of these people have any idea how much it sucks to be actually controversial. Like they think that they know, but they have no idea. I mean, like people who are in the game, and I would count myself in this, like we deal with, you know, it's funny. People who are famous, like famous, always complain about hate mail and all that stuff. I don't think they get shit compared to people who actually work in politics. And I just think a lot of people really aren't used to that. And look, I've even said this, which is like, it's not fun. It's not fun being controversial. I don't enjoy it, actually. I wish I could talk about literally anything else sometimes. But this is the career path that I've chosen, and that's fine. I am completely at peace with that. And also, the best politicians are not only at peace with that, they love the fight. Obama loved the fight. He loved it. He loved to give it back to the Republicans. He loved to get in it and get in the muck. Clinton loved the game. Trump loved the game too. Loved it. He loved having enemies. He loved sparring back and forth with them. Even Biden to a certain extent. I mean, he's literally just been in it for so long. He just doesn't care. You could literally call him a fascist to his face. And he genuinely wouldn't give a shit. Most of these celebs.
Send you a fake smile and just keep on his like, thing.
Yeah, he'd be like, grow up, young man, something like that. You know? I don't know. Like, he would say something. The point is that he would sleep fine at night. And I don't think a number of people who are that famous have any idea what it is like whenever you take a position on something that half the country does not fundamentally agree with, and that, you know, that there really is no right answer to either. It's easy, like I said, to draw a circle and say, I'll buy whatever you can put in this circle within 60 seconds. But I'm not criticizing him from a production standpoint. I think what he's done is tremendously ingenious, like in terms of basically back engineering how to get YouTube views. I think it's cool. I've actually learned a lot from him about how to make my own videos better. But yeah, it's one of those things where I'm like, don't presume to think that you know what you're doing. Although I guess I'll enjoy it. I'll enjoy watching it.
Yeah, look, I know people who are in their space are listening, and look, like the actual just suggestion is we're also not gatekeeping is a very critical thing here too. Like we're not making a gatekeeping argument. The argument is not like, where's your PhD? How about you go run for state senate first and then we'll see. It's really just like, hey, look, if Logan Paul or Mr. Beast or any of these people are serious, then the thing to actually do is keep doing your thing and actually just do the work. Like learn how the system works and we'll see how this turns out. Because like, once again, Ronald Reagan did not just wake up to your point, Sagar, in 1980 and say, hey, I was, top of the B-list Screen Actors Guild type guy. I'm going to be president now. I'm going to like spend 8 years on General Electric Theater, literally traveling around the country, talking to blue collar workers about the free market. Then I like was in charge of like Democrats for Nixon. Then I gave the big speech. Then I ran for governor. Then I primaried Gerald Ford. Like there's so much history, and that's why I like doing these episodes. Back,
his very first speech on before the McCarthy year, before HUAC.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, like he actually became political in 1949. That's what a lot of people need to know. Like almost 30 years. Before he ever,
there's a theme here, Sagar. Trump. Wow. So that's the actual theme. And once again, to your point, Mr. Beast is 24. So let's see where that goes.
Yeah, maybe he'll learn.
Next topic. I spoke of Richard Reeves this week. You spoke of Richard Reeves last week. Yeah. Let's talk about young men and boys. What's your top line reaction?
I think Richard's work is fantastic. I think the reason why is he genuinely is nonpartisan and non-cringe, which is like the hardest thing to do. He's like, look, I'm not proposing that we need to return to like the Christian ideal of 1955, which is why actually usually why people are most suspicious about talking why men and boys even are, you know, in crisis. He's like, I want to acknowledge this fact. I want everybody to do better. We can acknowledge that the victories of 1970s, 1960s feminism, and we've had a crazy reversal of the situation. There's nothing wrong with both celebrating a victory, admitting a defeat on one end, and then doing everything as possible. While he also articulates the problems with declining male wages and all that in just a really non like controversial way. I had a lot of women who watched my interview with him and were like, wow, I've really thought about this as a mom. And I just think it's so hard to do without sounding like bitter and angry with, I think a lot of the discussion online actually does come across.
Yeah. It's funny. I asked him this question, like, how do you have this conversation and not have it be zero sum? And him doing this work is the definition of that. It's funny. I'm sure you saw the kind of like right-wing backlash once Richard started getting a lot of pickup. It's when his Atlantic piece came out. Yeah, a bunch of like new right-wing Twitter was like, ah, this is the typical story. The right has been raising this issue for a long time. And then some center-left establishment-friendly person comes through and they are just going to take all our credit and like secularize it and make it very sort of technocratic and then they get all the credit. After having spoken with Richard, the easy response to that is Richard very much conceded that this work is about starting a conversation, which I think too much of right-wing social discourse, when it's even been correct, hasn't been able to do. So to his point, his criticism of the way the right has discussed it, so his criticism is as follows. I suggest people listen to the episode if they haven't already. A, he thinks the left just ignores this framework and is interested in discussing basically the world of the like 80s through the mid 2010s and not just like the world right now. And then he says the right, when it does discuss this issue, is more interested in weaponizing it. So I think that happens. I think that happens a lot. And I think what has to be recognized here from a deeply pragmatic perspective is if you are on the right and you're in that category of frustration with center-left people adopting the broad framework, is anything that starts with like feminism needs to be repudiated, that just isn't a thing. Like, you guys could launch as many like post-feminism trad-based like highbrow publications that Peter Thiel is like subsidizing. It's not going to actually like make a difference, because the thing that actually makes a difference is how do you put forth frameworks that work for people? And I loved his quote where he just says, look, I'll sum it up as follows. The labor market is favored towards men because of child rearing policies. Here's how we can address that. And right now, the educational space is moves towards women because women perform better under the current constructs that we have. And the question is, how can we make that better? Like, that is how you frame an issue in a way that people can do something with, not by like railing against like long dead third wave feminists who no one remembers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that's well said.
Next thing that I want to get to, just because I hope this is the last time we talk about it. It seems that Elon has purchased Twitter. What's the final word?
Maybe. I have nothing to say. Nothing. It's everything that's been said. I don't know. I mean, actually, I'll say this. I said actually today on the show, there are only two losers. One of them is Elon, who just paid double because he built it at the top of the market of what Twitter is actually worth. Twitter is probably worth like $20 billion and he has to pay 50. So, I mean, actually, okay, we could take people down memory lane. It is interesting that Elon is not conceiving of Twitter as buying Twitter, as fulfilling the original vision of X.com. And for people who don't know, X.com was the precursor to PayPal that merged with Peter Thiel and why Elon is a billionaire in the first place, which was his second most successful company. And that's what really put him on the map in terms of like generational wealth. I thought the original idea of X.com was actually really cool. What Elon is essentially envisioning is bringing a version of WeChat to the United States. And for people who don't know, in China, they basically have a single app which serves as your Venmo, your credit card, your Twitter, your Uber, your text message, everything all rolled into a single one, which Elon really was actually talking about in the beginning, which is why he called it X.com as an X for everything, and, or infinity or whatever. And so the idea that Twitter, because it's a handle, like a handle that you own, that could then serve as the cursor for sending payments. I mean, it makes sense. Like, you and I are on Twitter all the time. So like, why can't I pay you on Twitter through some sort of integration with the financial system? I still think his fucking work cut out for him though. I was like, it is going to be as difficult as getting that very first SpaceX rocket off the ground, even to make your money back. I don't really see how he can do it, but I'm not going to bet against the guy. I just think he's got his work cut out for him.
Yeah, I want to talk about the X.com thing because this is actually a personal fascination area of mine. I may end up doing an episode on the Chinese tech industry. And the reason why the Chinese have a WeChat everything app, it's so much of one of these like structural things where this only happens because of the nature of how tech evolves. So in the United States, we obviously started with desktops in the 90s with the internet. Because of the fact that China was a backwater into the 90s, they skipped the desktop era and went straight into
phones. Mobile. Yeah.
So if you start with the desktop era and websites, you're going to have PayPal.com. You're going to have eBay.com. You're going to have all these different sites that you go to. But if you start with a smartphone, you would just start with
one app.
Why do we need to have six different things of it? It could all be controlled under one specific application here. So the real question for Elon, it's not that the X for everything is a dumb idea. I think there's definitely something there. It's just the fact that if you don't have the starting from a blank slate thing, can you post-op do that? And guess what? I'm not going. I feel no need to send you. Like whenever we pay each other, we use Venmo.
Yeah, and, that's right. Yeah. And also my bank account's already connected, man.
Yeah, like, another weird thing, like, you know, mutual friend of ours, like Jules Terpak, was like talking about how, like, when she's talking to Gen Z people, like, they're not really on Twitter in the same way, right? Like, so, yeah, like, Twitter is centric for you and my lives because, like, you have a huge amount of followers. I have a respectable number of followers. But if you're just like a normal person of like 200 followers who are mostly your friends from college, like, why are you like having Twitter be the center of your social life? If anything, this should have been Instagram, Facebook. Probably. And if Facebook can't do this, then geez.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's going to be a tough one. I don't think he could do it, to be honest. I think it's going to be really, really hard. But look, I don't know. I mean, he's done crazier shit before. Maybe he can come up with something. It's certainly possible.
So yeah, my last word on it is someone had a great tweet where they said, here's my final word on Musk and Twitter. What I suspect is that, quote, Twitter is the equivalent of media in the sense that it's the most important thing in the world, but it's just not worth that much money. And that no matter how many BuzzFeeds you invest in, no matter how many Axioses, you're never going to build that multi-billion-dollar unicorn media company because media is just hard to monetize. They think Twitter is the same equivalent.
His idea of making people like us pay though does make a lot of sense. I think it is. I'd have to pay for it. $5 a month or whatever. I'd have no choice. Most people should not pay. But I mean, the idea of just forcing blue checks to pay is not a terrible idea since they have 99% or whatever of the followers. But again, I mean, to do that and make back $44 billion, that's a hell of a lot of money. Yep. I mean, you know, especially when you're already buying a company that's massively overvalued.
So for the last section, I want to talk about Putin's speech and Taiwan and a Richard Hanania post that we both great really post. Enjoyed.
Yeah.
So top line here is obviously last week, Putin gave his big speech announcing the illegal annexation of Ukrainian territory. And there were some really good threads that have just threaded together the entire thing. And it's the type of speech that, to be like a little chauvinist, like modern leaders don't really give anymore. If you like really like took out some of the technological references, this just could have, like, you could see a king delivering this speech.
Yeah. I really think he's a czar. I think of him as a czar.
Yeah, you're right. It's not even actually, to your point, it's not as if like, you know, Queen Victoria couldn't have given the speech and had it mattered. Mm-hmm. This is like if like Nicholas II or like Alexander III in the 1800s, like gave like this big speech. And I'd love for you, Sagar, if you could remember off the top of your head to really summarize A, like what Richard is arguing in his piece that we'll link as well too. But frankly, I'll say that like, it's interesting that Richard himself, who's like not a pro-Ukraine guy, I think would be fair to say. He's not Mr. Look at the triumph of the West as the Russian bear runs with its tail between its legs. Like, what's his argument in direct response to Putin's speech?
Richard's argument is that Putin's speech, the fact that it has to be given at all from such a position of like vast failure and obvious humiliation, is that the Russian model actually just is not going to work. And like, even though Putin, the regime itself, if there is a negotiated settlement and we don't end up in a nuclear war, is very likely to survive in some sort of like quasi autocratic oligarchic state, that like, this is just not it. They are not going to return to superpower status under the current iteration of the Russian regime. And his other point that he juxtaposes China with is that the sheer idiocy of COVID zero actually shows that the CCP, when they have to choose between control over their population and prosperity on the global stage with economic success, is that they're just going to choose control over their population. And I mean, I think there was a lot of evidence before that, but COVID zero is actually just so profoundly stark, dumb and humiliating to like to literally lock people in your home for 40 straight days in 2022. That's fucking crazy. Like, that's just crazy. And the fact that they are so unable to admit that it was such a stupid idea, again, same thing. Like, they just cannot let it go. And it's one of those really good, just like basic takes that, yeah, actually, the American system is just going to be the one that triumphs across the globe. I'm not going to say we're going to win. Like, I'm not going to say that it is costless and isn't dangerous. But his point is just like, in the long run, most countries will look just like us if they want to ensure their longevity and if they want to ensure their prosperity. That doesn't mean that it will happen. That doesn't mean all of that. More what he was saying is, he's like, the idea that in 2022 that you could become the Chinese superpower or the Russian superpower in their current like absolute autocratic models is just basically being disproven before our eyes. That does not mean to say that they don't have nuclear weapons. It's not very, very dangerous. Just that status quo, like they're not going to win or they're not going to like rule the earth in the models that they have created. Very likely. It could be wrong, but I think he's right.
Yeah. And the key thing here is, the important thing to understand about China and Russia is the Chinese objective isn't just, we want to take Taiwan and unify and, you know, solidify control over Hong Kong and basically, you know, secure our conception of like the reborn post-century humiliation Chinese nation. It's also that the Chinese want to very aggressively push back what they see as like the Western U.S. dominated world order, because the key thing when you said like it's not that like Russia and China are going to take over the world, your claim isn't that, you know, Russian paratroopers, Red Dawn style, were going to like land all over Kansas. The point is that what the Russians and the Chinese are attempting to do is they are revisionist powers. They very explicitly state that like the post-World War II order is a Western U.S.-centric, biased and hypocritical status quo that holds everyone else down. That's their articulation. And my reaction to that is, man, this is why timing and everything matters. It's one thing for Putin to give a speech where he's like, the US is a hypocrite, the US is an imperialist power, and they just want to hold everyone down. If it's like the 2000s, right? Like, think of—
Well, he did give that speech in the 2000s, but yeah.
But not in the same way. Like, when he gives the Munich speech in, you know, 2007, it's very like, it's a very reactive speech. This speech was him basically making his case. His case is, once again, like I said, the US world order is a load of bollocks and we should replace it with something new. To offer that up now is just pathetic. It's just, like, once again, to your point, like, no matter what happens in Ukraine, no one is going to say, you know what? The Russian system has something going to it. And at the same time, too, the best the Russians could get, the best they can get is they can get essential like countries like the Middle East, the countries in the Middle East, like India, who are like, we just don't want to pick a side and like get involved. But no one's siding with Russia. Like even the Chinese basically are not siding with Russia right now. And that's telling. And if you are going to try to challenge the status quo, you actually need allies. And yes, I know that there are definitely some people in the comments who are like, well, you know, if you look, you know, the African countries are getting, you know, aid from China and they don't like the dollar and this, that is not how challenges to the world order are maintained, right? The American world order persists not merely because the US has like a lot of like force or because everyone thinks that the United States is this nice, brilliant Uncle Sam giving everything out of their bounty and friendship. It's because the status quo is pretty consistently working for basically everybody. And right now, all the Russians and Chinese have demonstrated is a world order that they led, or a world order without the United States or the West having as much influence as they would be one where they would invade other countries. And that's where the tension comes. And that's why I think if they're going to try to make their case, they have to do a better job of actually like reflecting, wait, like, how is the same boss not just the same as the old boss with also more chaos? Because Joe Biden's not invading any countries like we invaded Iraq. Also another reason why the Iraq invasion was such a disaster when it came to actually pushing back against the Russians and Chinese.
No, that's what I was going to say, which is that's what part of the reason why Iraq was so bad, which is that it's all they talk about. There's a famous story where Bush in 05, I think, was lecturing Putin about democracy. And he was like, we do not want the type of democracy that they have in Baghdad. And Bush basically was like, I mean, he's like speechless. I had nothing to say. And I mean, the Chinese, I've heard this from people who do bilateral meetings with the Chinese. They love Iraq. All they talk about is Iraq, 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 Iraq. North Korea, too. Whenever they met with Trump, and Trump was like, why don't you just give up those nuclear weapons? He was like, what about Iraq? What about Gaddafi? He's like, we're not giving these up. He's like, we don't trust you. He's like, Gaddafi gave up his nukes. And he's like, and you killed him. And you know what? I don't blame him. I'd probably do the same thing. So yeah, this is why it's just so difficult, you know?
You know what the tragedy is? Because obviously like, we're doing a lot of thinking about nuclear weapons. The devastating take is that the Iraq war effectively just destroyed any prospects for ever having nuclear disarmament,
you know,
within
what's
a reasonable
his name
time
said
frame.
That?
Who said that?
Gene Edward Smith said that. Gene Edwards, or maybe it was Thomas Ricks. Actually, it might have been one of them, either or. One of them wrote at the end of their book, I really don't remember who wrote it, which is that the day may come whenever United States may actually have to need to launch a so-called preemptive war in order to stop nuclear annihilation. And George W. Bush, in his idiocy by directing it at Saddam Hussein in 2003, has destroyed that case for over a generation and likely driven the United States closer to nuclear war than at any point before. I do not remember who said that. Very prescient. Though it's either Ricks or it's Gene Edward Smith. I can't remember. It might have been Ricks now that I think about it, but he was totally right. He was totally, I thought about, the reason why I remember is because I thought about that a lot in 2017 when I thought we might be going to war with North Korea, which by the way, when you and I are talking, not good right now. They're throwing, they just launched a ballistic missile 2,700 miles over the Japanese EEZ. People in Japan are freaking out. You know, they basically had to go into bunkers and they got alerts all over their television. So yeah, global stability is not great right now.
But the key thing is, and this is why it's really tough, right? Because we're obviously in the States right now as we're wrapping here. But look, Vietnam discredited the US and then it was the 80s. And I think what clearly the North Koreans, the Iranians, the Russians, and the Chinese undercounted is the world's memory relative to the stakes is shorter than they would think. At the end of the day, Putin, and I get this, like you and I could be empathetic in the sense that, if imagine like a Russian version of you and I, we're going to talk like but we're in government, we are going to like think about the Iraq war for the rest of our lives, obviously. But guess what? If you are in Germany or you're in France, two countries which oppose the Iraq war, that's not what they're like, whether or not they agree for a policy or not. Macron and Scholz are not waking up and saying, well, you know, that one time four US presidents ago, we're really going to think about this, 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 and that. In the same way that a West German prime minister was not letting LBJ's escalation in 1965 shape how a possible nuclear conflict over Berlin could go in the 1980s. And just like the myopia and the inability to realize that is, and I think it's also an important lesson of how, once again, like I'm not asking listeners to just like get over the Iraq war, because it's going to be a stain on the rest of our lifetimes. But I think it's also just important to note that we can't be perpetually stuck in the year 2003, especially if, like, you and I, we didn't do it, is kind of the way I put it. Like, you could, the response to, let's say Desert Storm was not, well, like, do we have moral authority because, like, we invaded Vietnam? To a certain point, you have to really separate the useful from the, like, the useless. And the useful, by the way, well, go on.
I would just say that superpowers just get a lot more wiggle room. I mean, I think that's just the truth. And, like,
that's
guess
a
what?
Good point.
The Brits had a really fucked up war against the Boers, and they didn't really do anything to the British Empire. Like that's,
and I just think, and that, they were part of like the Grand Council during World War One.
That's
the
guy,
like Schmutz, I think, who like fought that, Jan Smuts. Yes. He was a part. Right. He was in the UK during the war. Like,
that's what I'm saying.
Ten years later, like,
yeah, it was a horrific, disastrous war.
Invented the concentration camp. Really, yeah, not
literally
good.
Invented the concentration camp. They killed a lot of people. The British public was like mostly against it. World opinion was too. And the British Empire was fine. And continued for another 50 years. Now, obviously, you know, the height, et cetera, and all of that. But yeah, when you're the world's superpower, you just get a lot more wiggle room. Whereas with Putin, I mean, you know, invading Ukraine effectively has put his regime completely on the line. You can say what you want about Iraq. The legitimacy of the US presidency was never put into question as a result of it. And that's just the difference.
So last thing before we break for the weekend, what are you reading right now? It's interesting for folks.
Oh, reading a couple of interesting things. I'm re-listening to the book about the Cuban Missile Crisis for obvious reasons.
Are you doing 1 minute to midnight?
Yeah, 1 minute to midnight.
On my Audible, Serhii Plohii's, if you want to listen to a new one, very good. He's at Harvard. He does a lot of Russian history books. Searching my library right now. Okay, so you're doing. I'll search the name. But you're okay. So you're doing Cuban Missile Crisis.
I'm reading a book about the 1960s called Chaos: Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s.
Nice. I did that.
I'm reading.
It's a little hard. I haven't read or listened to Helter Skelter before. I wish I had before I listened to Chaos, because it's a little confusing.
So I listened to a summary of Helter Skelter.
You are smarter than I am. That's the way to do it.
And then we're listening to Fire and Blood, because I love House of the Dragon. Love Fire and Blood. Fire and Blood may be better than any of the other Game of Thrones books.
I heard it's kind of like a textbook, right?
Yeah, kind of. It's fantastic. I love it. I don't know. I really love the intricate backstory that George R. R. Martin has created for the Targaryens.
Yeah.
It's genuinely better. I'll tell you why it's better. It's less complicated. It's only one book. So you basically get the entire history of the Targaryen. You're like, okay, I get it now. And now I can watch House of the Dragon, and I basically know most of what is going to happen. Some things have changed, but the story is really good. It's really,
yeah.
Really recommend it if anybody likes the show.
The book I mentioned is Nuclear Folly, A History of the Cuban Missile Crisis, came out last year. And then what am I listening to that I would recommend? You would like this one, Sagar. Stalingrad. It's actually the book that, it's called Enemy at the Gates. It's the book Jude Law movie from 2001 was based on. It's from the 70s. But unlike a lot of 70s books, it actually reads really, really well. It's very interesting. Like, obviously, like the talk of like the war in Ukraine is like got this on my mind. But yeah, Bottle of Stalingrad, it's bad. Like everything you've heard, it's 100 times worse is basically the takeaway of that one. So threw a lot of recommendations to people. The Substack is going out later today, so we'll have those included. love you guys joining us for our discussions. And of course, check out our Supercast, realignment.supercast.com, if you've not already, to support the show. See you all next time.
You guys.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.